A fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Hannah Francis, Mel Gertob, Anna Wilcox, Ken Jones, Josh Salem, and Dave Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, and Isabel Charlet. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our fall fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by September 20th. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Portland is blessed with an amazing literary community. Could be for a wealth of reasons. Our independent bookstores, the perfect for reading weather, the world-class coffee, annual traditions like the Portland Book Festival, all attractive for those engaged in what can be a lonely pursuit. But don't overlook the influence of another annual tradition, the Portland Writers Picnic, which started back in 2014 and, despite a few years lost to COVID, is still going strong. In fact, the 9th annual Portland Writers Picnic takes place this Sunday, September 7th at Laurelhurst Park from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And if you're a writer in or around Portland, you're invited. We're fortunate to have three of the picnic organizers and literary luminaries in their own right, Steve Arndt, Gigi Little, and Carmel Brannick, live in the KBOO studios to give us all the details. Steve, Gigi, Carmel, thanks for being here for what's become our own annual tradition.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Steve, first a little background on the Portland Writers Picnic. You were there for the first one in 2014, and I think it was your idea?
The idea was mine, but it found a home real quick with Gigi Little and some others in our writing group. So it wasn't hard. I think Portland is, our writing committee already kind of knows without thinking about it, that we have a special collectiveness. And so it's not hard to get something like a picnic going. You just need to get it announced. And you need to have maybe a couple of years where it becomes familiar with everybody. But it's, these people are all ready for something like this.
Oh, yes, it definitely seemed. I mean, this is your 9th one, so obviously it's caught on.
Well, we go to readings. Uh-huh. We get 20 minutes before the readings to say hi, hi, hi. Because we love all these people. We want to talk to them. And then after the readings, we got another 20 minutes before everybody goes home and hi, hi, hi. This picnic is agendaless. There's no plans for a book reading or anything like that. It's purely for writers to get to know other writers. And really, we would love to have more entry-level writers come in and find what's waiting for them in this very safe and kind community.
Well, when writers talk to you about their experience at the picnic, Steve, what are you hearing the most? What are you hearing the most when they talk to you about their experience? What kind of comments do they get?
Oh. Well, this is one thing I heard the other day at a reading that I didn't acknowledge to the two people, but two women were talking behind me, and they said, oh, I met you. Oh, I met you at the writer's picnic. That's what I want to hear, something like that. And but what we talk about It can be anything. How's your daughter? How's your dog? What are you working on right now? How's that particular problem you were having with that one scene? You know, it might be very particular, or it might be just enjoying each other's smiles and laughter. And that's as important as anything else we might have in the way of a writing community. You might have a community where they study writing. They have different programs that study writing. This is just enjoying your community.
It's just, that, yeah, just a get-together where people get to know each other.
Yeah.
Gigi, what's involved each year in planning the Writer's Picnic, prepping the site in Laurelhurst Park, and getting the word out?
I mean, it's sort of a... Because we've been doing it so long, it kind of runs on its own steam at this point. You know, we have our, you know, the supplies that we always keep on hand and have ready to pull out. And I make a little graphic and, you know, share it on social media. And that's sort of how we start to get the word out. And then, yeah, most of the stuff, I mean, we have to, you know, get the park permission to use
the park
and all.
Area.
Yeah. And then just, we will get there early, on Sunday and, you know, clean everything up and put out the tablecloths and putting out the food and, you know, it's kind of a well-oiled machine at this point.
Yeah. Well, 9 years, you know, that happens. Now, Steve mentioned, one of the things he wanted most was to attract newer writers, people who haven't been to the picnic before. Given the popularity of the event, you no doubt have writers who return every year and those who know each other maybe through writing groups, book events. How do you attract writers who might be new in town or possibly new to writing?
That's hard. That is hard. I guess the biggest thing is word of mouth. And thanks to you, this, and hopefully people out there will be listening today and will say, you know, I mean... You don't have to have a book and you don't have to have a published story. You don't have to have anything. You just have to love to write and want to write.
Now, Carmelie, remembering back to your first Writer's Picnic when you were kind of a novice here and concerns you might have had, how do you and the other organizers make first-timers feel welcome and part of the community?
Well, we always keep an eye out for anyone who we feel is new to the picnic. And we'll welcome them over, you know, introduce them to other people, chat with them, make sure they're comfortable, show them where the food is. And everyone's so nice and friendly and welcoming. I think it's just one of the most welcoming events there is. So I don't think anyone has to be too anxious about it.
Now, you have a completed manuscript, a memoir titled Briefly I Knew My Mother, and you're currently looking for a publisher, a situation common to almost all writers at some point. Do you find the picnic a good place to exchange ideas and suggestions? Steve mentioned it's kind of a mix of shop talk and, you know, how you doing or...
Yeah, absolutely. I love that part of it. And as Steve and Gigi mentioned, it is definitely a place where people chat about anything. But often the writing and the work and the project we're working on at the moment does come up. And I've talked to other writers about querying and about agents and about how we got into writing and, of course, what genre we're writing. And it's just a very great place to exchange ideas and support each other.
And there's some experts there. I know earlier in the year I did an interview with Laura Stanfill of Forest Avenue Press on her book Imagine a Door, which is basically a guide for writers.
Exactly.
Through all these stages of the manuscript.
Yes.
Now, Gigi, speaking of completed projects, you have a debut novel coming out in October. I'm very excited about it. Who Killed Won the Gun from Portland's Forest Avenue Press, Laura Stanfill's press.
Yeah.
It has its roots in your love for old-time radio, especially the detective shows of the 1940s and 50s, including my personal favorite, yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yeah, one of my favorites, too. Yeah.
Can you give us a preview of the book?
Oh, gosh. well, I mean... I would just say that it is, it's a murder mystery, like you say. It's also, it's a genre bender, as they say, because it also is sci-fi, because our protagonist is in a time loop. Also, the people in this place, which is maybe kind of America, but not America, everybody's name is a number with a rhyme, so Who Killed Won the Gun A friend told me recently that my title gave him an aneurysm.
What's the connection, though? Is it
one, the gun is the name of the first character. That's the detective. Two, the True Blue is his assistant.
Oh, but what's the how did he get the aneurysm?
His brain exploded, I guess. He didn't understand. You know, it's a strange title, I guess. You know, to sort of clock. That's a total pun. I did not mean to pun, but there's a lot of clocks in
it's unique
as well. Yeah.
Well, I'm really looking forward to reading that, and that comes out in October.
Yeah.
Now, Steve, Gigi told me she's also working on a project with you, a collection of your writing, essays, poetry, fiction, and I love the idea, Steve Arndt Anthology. How's that coming along?
It's been a very busy year for Gigi, so we've had to find, we found time. I would go over to her house and we go through our different pages that I've got, essays or poems, or bits from my novel, and I'm comfortable with it. But it does, to me, feel a little uncomfortable to kind of say, "Here's a guy who hasn't finished a book, but we're going to go ahead and."
Well, you're excerpting from a 700-page novel, so whether it's finished or not, that's a lot of writing, Steve.
Yeah, well, in any case, I'm glad I wrote the book, whether it ever got published or not. People got to realize that. If you wrote a book and it never gets published, you can lean on that quite proudly if you've written a book. And I feel that way. I feel like in that novel, there wasn't one throwaway sentence that I thought hard for every sentence within the realm of what the voice might say in his world. And
now you also have another project that's not a writing project so much as a kind of a celebration of writing, and that's your Spanbauerians kind of readings and events at Bold Coffee Shop downtown Portland.
Yeah, I've been allowed to maybe be the guy that coined the word Spanbauerian,
which I can't pronounce. But
but there's a lot of us. A lot of us studied under Tom, going back in the early 90s. And finishing up in the early teens. And each of us have our own relationship with Tom, our own thing we might say. So I'm sponsoring curating a quarterly thing at Bold Coffee and Books, Ali Shaw's new place. And we're calling it Steve Arndt and the Spanbauerians.
it sounds like a 60s band.
So now October 17th is our next one, and we have Bradley Rosen. We have Monica Drake, Marco Malone, and David Simonello.
Wow, some all-stars.
Yeah. But there are people that are obscurely left behind in Tom's group that wrote beautiful things that we need to bring forward and introduce. And so I'm gonna be very deep into the group, hopefully, as time goes along.
Now talking about kind of exposing works that we might not know, to help showcase the Portland writing community, I asked all of you before the show to recommend a few books, especially ones you've read over the past year, maybe a few you're looking forward to in the next month or two. Carmel, you want to go ahead? We'll start with you.
Yeah, there's so many wonderful writers bringing out books, and some in the last year that I've really enjoyed were Omar El-Akkad's One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This, Holly Brickley's Deep Cuts, Amy Mason Doan's The California Dreamers, Renee Denfil's Sleeping Giants, and more recently, Nancy Townsley's Sunshine Girl.
Oh, what a great list.
But there's so many.
Yeah, I've done a few interviews with some of the writers, and Amy's actually coming up in December, I think.
Oh, wonderful.
For California Dreaming.
Yeah.
Gigi, what titles are on your list?
The first title I want to give a shout out to is Mo Davio's Epic and Lovely, which is just out, and her book launch is actually tonight.
At Annie Bloom's Books.
It's actually across the street from Annie Bloom's at a place called The Butterfly Effect, 7 o'clock tonight. So, it's a fabulous, fabulous book. Like Carmel said, there are so many books that I'm afraid to miss
all. You'll leave something out.
I'm going to leave most of them out, but I want to make mention of Diane Greenwood's Blackbird Whistling, which also just came out. You had already mentioned Imagine a Door, which is Laura Stanfill's book about writing, which I think is important to mention since Portland, Writers Picnic is all about writers, and this is a book for writers. Nightbird by Siobhan Scott. The Bequest by Susie Vitello is coming out very soon. You know, Reading the Waves by Ludi Yuknovich. Of course, that came out this year, I believe. That was back in March. Yeah. Michael Keefe has a new book, Western Terminus. So many books.
Yes. Steve, were there any books that we haven't mentioned yet that are on your list?
Well, I have to mention Imagine a Door. Laura is so brilliant, but she's also so human. I asked her once about her first novel. I said, what have people not said about your first novel? And she thought for it, she said, kindness. And I've kept that word in my repertoire of words, and I've allowed it more meaning than it used to have. But I want to mention Gigi's book. I've been with her for a long time. And to do all the things she does, this asking the reader to suspend their reality and get that on the page in a way that the reader is taken care of, it's very hard work. That's doing the work of a writer. And I commend her on that. The sentences are beautiful. I like books where you read a paragraph, and in every paragraph there's a little surprise. It might be a thought, or it might be a couple of words next together you never thought you'd ever see next to each other.
Well, Steve, Gigi, Carmel, thanks so much for joining us at KABU. Wishing you good food, good company, and perfect weather on Sunday, and many more writers' picnics to come.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
We've been talking live in the KABU studios with Steve Arndt, Gigi Little, and Carmel Brannick about the 2025 Portland Writers' Picnic, which takes place this Sunday, September 7th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Laurelhurst Park, Picnic Area E. All Portland area writers and their families are welcome. Just bring a dish to share, something you'd like to drink, ice coolers, paper plates, silverware, and that wonderful feeling of community provided. This is Ken Jones for KABU's News In Depth.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. The U.S. labels the International Criminal Court a national security threat. Strains in the U.S.-South Korea alliance. And a summit of authoritarian world leaders is held in Beijing. Labels the International Criminal Court a national security threat. The State Department said the U.S. will impose sanctions on two ICC judges and two prosecutors for, quote, transgressions against the U.S. and Israel. The ICC said the sanctions were a, quote, flagrant attack against the independence of an impartial judicial institution, unquote, that operates under the mandate of 125 countries. The State Department has targeted a judge from France for his role in issuing arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and his one-time defense minister, Yoav Gallant, and for Kimberly Prost of Canada, another judge, for her role in authorizing an investigation into U.S. military personnel at secret CIA sites in the years after the September 11 attacks in 2001. The sanctions freeze any assets the judges may have in the United States. These sanctions continue the Trump administration's assault on international law. In June, the State Department announced sanctions on four other International Criminal Court judges and the chief prosecutor for obtaining war crimes convictions of Netanyahu and Gallant. Neither the U.S. nor Israel is a party to the Rome Treaty that established the International Criminal Court. Arrest warrants are also being sought for three Hamas leaders. Strains in the U.S.-South Korea alliance. As President Lee Jae-myung prepared to meet with Donald Trump last week, Lee found that he would not only have to deal with high tariffs and China strategy, but also with Trump's unhappiness about the state of Korean politics. "What is going on in South Korea?" Trump wrote on social media. "Seems like a purge or revolution. We can't have that and do business there." Was this another intervention in a friendly country's politics, as Trump attempted with Brazil, or was it a phony attempt to strike a better trade deal? Trump probably was referring to an arrest warrant filed by Korean prosecutors for the former Prime Minister Han Duck-soo, whom they accused of trying to help the country's former president, Yoon Suk-yeol, to impose martial law after he was impeached. Yoon has been arrested twice in the last year on various charges related to his ill-fated bid to stay in power. Lee's talk with Trump turned out to be reasonably successful, in that Lee got Trump to reduce the U.S. tariff rate on Korean goods to 15%, though it had been zero before Trump's tariff war. Nevertheless, Korean banks believe the economy, heavily dependent on exports to the U.S., will inevitably take a hit. But Korea's proposal for joint shipbuilding struck a positive chord with Trump. For South Korea, the trade framework previously established is just one source of upset over U.S. policies. Another is China. Will U.S. forces stationed in Korea be used to contain China, as opposed to deterring North Korea? Is South Korea expected to participate in defense of Taiwan if China attacks Taiwan? A third issue is defense payments to the U.S. Trump wants a major increase to $10 billion. In short, U.S.-Korea relations have only temporarily been smoothed over with President Lee's trip. Of authoritarian world leaders is held in Beijing. The leaders of China, Russia, and India, all with grudges to bear against the United States, came together in Beijing under the auspices of the 26-member Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO. Most important was the appearance of India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, whose dispute with Donald Trump over tariffs and the Nobel Peace Prize has upended the once close relationship between the U.S. and India. Now it looks like India has joined in a Sino-Russian project to create an alternative world order. Xi Jinping says he wants partnership, not rivalry with India. Modi agreed, but insisted that India be viewed as an independent actor, not a U.S. ally. Nevertheless, it will be hard for China and India to paper over their long-running border dispute, India's rejection of China's Belt and Road Initiative, and Chinese resentment of India's refusal to endorse SCO joint statements. Xi Jinping had the key role at the summit, urging unity against decoupling and power politics and support for multipolar politics, all signature Chinese themes addressed to U.S. hegemony. Xi and Modi had a private one-on-one conversation during the meeting. China has proposed that the SCO, like the BRICS, establish its own development bank. Xi announced billions of dollars in grants, loans, and scholarships to the SCO states. Russia's economy is weakening. Forbes magazine reports that, quote, Russia could slip into a recession soon and is having its worst harvest in 17 years, further straining an economy that's already seen energy revenue plunge, unquote. That is the view of Tatiana Orlova, lead economist for emerging markets at Oxford Economics. The fact that the Alaska summit between Putin and Trump did not produce any agreement to promote U.S.-Russia economic cooperation informs her forecast, which also sees Russian GDP growth slowing sharply this year to just 1.2% from 4.3% in 2024. Russia's economy minister has also forecast a recession, and Russian banks worry about a debt crisis. The central budget is showing the strains of 3.5 years of war. Anders Aslund, a prominent European Russia specialist, says that, quote, Russia's economy is fast approaching a fiscal crunch that will encumber its war effort. Though that may not be enough to compel Putin to seek peace, it does suggest that the walls are closing in on him. Democratic staff report cites Trump's easing of sanctions on Russia. A minority staff report for two Senate committees argues that the Trump administration halted new sanctions and export controls on Russia for 6 months, leading to a significant drop in pressure on Russia. The report found that when Trump took office, the administration, quote, immediately stopped taking basic sanctions and export control actions that had maintained and increased U.S. pressure, unquote. Further, says the report, the administration has further undermined Ukraine's leverage by repeatedly signaling a lack of commitment to maintaining effective sanctions, unquote. For example, the report cites the administration's weakening of the G7 group's position on Russia sanctions, its disbanding of a key initiative against Russian oligarchs, its undermining of Europe's sanctions on a Russian bank, its rejection of a G7 proposal to help crack down on opaque Russian oil exports, and its public statements that sanctions on Russia are too costly to implement. Japan-U.S. trade talks hit a snag. Japan's top trade negotiator canceled his trip to the U.S. at the last minute. Quote, "It was found that there are points that need to be discussed at the administrative level during coordination with the American side. Therefore, the trip has been canceled," said a Japanese government spokesperson. The snag evidently has to do with the investment promise that the Japanese had made, a promise which, as I discussed last week, led Trump to boast that it would put $550 billion in the U.S. government's pocket. That's not what the Japanese intended. Trump's tariffs are ruled illegal. A federal appeals court on August 29th determined that Trump did not have the authority to impose tariffs worldwide, striking down Trump's use, or abuse really, of the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. That act does not authorize tariffs or the trade deficit as actions that fall within a national emergency. However, the court allowed the tariffs to remain in place on the assumption the Supreme Court will take them up. Trump's response, quote, "If these tariffs ever went away, it would be a total disaster for the country," unquote. That's strange. Before the tariffs were imposed, the country was doing just fine. Next, three items on the war in Israel. First, journalists are a target. As of August 25th, 244 journalists have been killed in the war. The latest casualties were four journalists from four different news agencies. They were killed in an horrific Israeli Defense Forces attack on a Gaza hospital. There is little doubt that journalists are not simply collateral damage. They are being targeted. U.S. news agencies have been nearly silent about the attacks, even as their own affiliated journalists die. The second item concerns Israeli public opinion, which remains highly divided and contradictory on the war. A report by the International Institute for Strategic Studies finds that despite strong public support for the Netanyahu government's strikes on Iran, 82% of Jewish Israelis supported the strikes against Iran, and 61% favored expanding the war's goals to include regime change, nevertheless, opinion continues to be contradictory. More than two-thirds of the Israeli public favored a war-ending hostage deal in July, including 86% of opposition voters, but nearly as many also wanted to see Hamas completely destroyed. The political upshot is that the Knesset, Israel's parliament, is deadlocked. Netanyahu isn't strong enough to call for an election to stay in office, and the opposition doesn't have enough votes to oust him. And the third item, Trump's Gaza development scheme is revealed. The Washington Post published a leaked prospectus for the plan, which would involve the forced displacement of Gaza's entire population of 2 million people and put the territory into a U.S. trusteeship for at least a decade. The plan would be the realization of Donald Trump's and Jared Kushner's dream to transform Gaza into a high-tech Riviera with megacities powered by AI. Palestinian residents would be given a choice, either voluntarily relocate outside the country or be given a Bitcoin to move to micro-homes and receive a pittance for their property. A human rights executive based in Switzerland called the plan, quote, "a textbook case of international crimes on an unimaginable scale, forcible population transfer, demographic engineering, and collective punishment," unquote. He and others warned that companies that invest in the plan would be subject to lawsuits for abetting ethnic cleansing. No official in Washington or Tel Aviv could be reached for comment. Next, two very different stories on the environmental front. First, some good news, major gains in global hygiene. From Fix the News on Substack, billions of people have gained clean water, sanitation, and hygiene in the last 9 years. New data from the World Health Organization and UNICEF show that between 2015 and 2024, humanity recorded one of the fastest expansions of basic welfare of all time. 961 million people gained safe drinking water, 1.2 billion gained safe sanitation, and 1.5 billion gained access to basic hygiene services, while the number of unserved fell by nearly 900 million. Coverage has risen to 74%, 58%, and 80% respectively, while open defecation has dropped by 429 million people. Together, these figures represent an historic advance in human health and dignity. On the other hand, in Pakistan, switching to solar power has cost the poor. Solar power has become the top source of electricity in Pakistan, as imports of solar panels from China have taken off. One would think this is great news for all Pakistanis, as solar has been adopted everywhere, even in mosques, and savings on electricity have been huge. But not for everyone. Only the rich have gone off the power grid, leaving the poor, who cannot afford the solar panels, to rely on coal-powered energy. And as wealthier people leave the grid, the electricity becomes more expensive for those who still rely on it. It's a death spiral, says one solar executive. Pakistan is thus in an awful energy quandary. It overinvested in coal power and now has too many plants and high debts. On the other hand, too many people are going off the grid and onto solar, leaving the country energy divided. Finally, two updates. First, from Thailand, where the Constitutional Court dismissed Prime Minister Pettongtong Shinawatra, the youngest prime minister in the country's history, for an ethics violation. She became the sixth premier from or backed by the billionaire Shinawatra family to be removed by the military or judiciary in a tumultuous two-decade battle for power between the country's warring elites. Thai politics is now in upheaval as those elites contend for control of the prime ministership. And second, in India, the export economy is reeling as Trump's 50% tariffs begin. Business and workers in textiles, jewelry, carpets, and shrimp are all suffering due to their dependence on the U.S. market. Exporter associations estimate that the tariffs could affect nearly 55% of India's $87 billion worth of merchandise exports to the U.S. and benefit competitors such as Vietnam, Bangladesh, and China, which have been tariffed at lower rates.